Concordia Theological Seminary presents We Are Yours, O David, the Eschatology of Chronicles, a paper presented on January 18, 2000 by Dr. Daniel L. Gard at the 15th Annual Symposium on Exegetical Theology held at Concordia Theological Seminary.
First acquaintance with Daniel Gard was not in person, but was an encounter with his sermons that he submitted to us as part of the process of evaluating potential professors of homiletics. In those sermons, it was very clear to me that here was a pastor whose lively mind engaged people with the person of Jesus Christ, and that the viva vox of the gospel was very evident in his preaching. Dr. Gard came to us as a professor in 1989, a 1984 graduate of this institution with an MA and PhD from Notre Dame, where he majored in Hebrew Bible, Judaica, and minored in the New Testament and early church, as well as liturgical theology. Dan now teaches in the exegetical department, although, like others before him, he cut his teeth teaching homiletics and pastoral courses. Dan is known among us as a fierce supporter of the students, a passion he expressed administratively as Vice President of Student and Family Services, which is simply a fancy name for Dean of Students. Dan is quite multi-talented as an administrator, holding positions here at the seminary, such as D-Min Supervisor, Acting Dean of the Chapel, and now he is Dean of Distance Education and Assessment. Dan could have a very successful career as a Navy chaplain. He is so well respected by his colleagues in the Navy that he is in constant demand to be an instructor or administrator all over the world. We tease Dan on how he suffers for the cross in such places like Spain and Sicily, San Diego, and Newport, Rhode Island. But Dan has found himself in some very difficult situations in the Naval Reserves, and his pastoral gifts are evident as he exhibits fierce support for his colleagues in the Navy as he does for his students here at the seminary. Dan is also a very devoted husband to Annette and a father to his two daughters, Rachel and Hannah, and it has been my privilege to be a colleague of Dan's and a friend during these past 10 years. This is Dan's first symposium paper, long overdue, but on a topic that is near and dear to his heart. His PhD thesis was entitled Warfare in Chronicles, and he has been selected by Concordia Commentary to write the volume on 1st and 2nd Chronicles. Will you welcome with me Dr. Daniel Gard?
That was more gentle than I expected. Thank you, Arthur. It is indeed a pleasure to be here. I have a handout for you. It's one of those things when you do very quickly, you regret. Reverend is not reverend, it's E-N-D. I identified that just recently. Apologize for that misspelling, but I do hope that the handout some of you may have received by now will be helpful. At the beginning of the handout, you read a quotation from St. Jerome. St. Jerome wrote that the book of Chronicles, the epitome of the old dispensation, is of such importance that without it, anyone who claims to have a knowledge of the scriptures makes himself a fool. Well, if Jerome was right, and I believe that he was, the contemporary church leads a rather theologically deprived life. And that's no less true for our reading of biblical eschatology as for anything else. For example, the 1989 CTCR document, The End Times, cites Chronicles only once, and in that process cites Chronicles incorrectly. I submit that the question of biblical eschatology is incomplete if and only partially answered if Chronicles is not considered along with the rest of the canon. But to address any group on the books of Chronicles is to immediately confront the problem of a general lack of familiarity with the text on the part of many people. Let me begin then simply by rehearsing some basic eisegetical facts for you. The books of Chronicles come at the end of the 5th century BC, some 100 years after Cyrus allowed the captives to return to the land. And thus, this book closes out the Hebrew Bible, and in fact, in the Hebrew canon, even appears last in the canon. Broadly speaking, there are two great sections of Chronicles, chapters 1 through 9 in 1 Chronicles, the genealogies, and then chapter 10 of 1 Chronicles through the end, 2 Chronicles 36, which are the narrative section. The narrative section itself can be divided really into three basic groupings. First, the reign of David in 1 Chronicles 10 through 29. Second, the reign of Solomon in 2 Chronicles 1 through 9. And then the history of the divided kingdom through the exile and the return in 2 Chronicles 10 through 2 Chronicles 36. Now, a lot of ink, frankly, has been expended, I think, in an ongoing battle between conservatives and critics over the historic reliability of the Chronicles. Clearly, the chronicler does use a forelog, that is a text from which he that forms the basic structure of his own narrative, and that is the biblical books of Samuel and Kings. But he also uses a number of other sources, and he provides the names of many of these throughout his work. For example, the Chronicles of the prophet Iddo. Many of these, or almost all of these, we have no idea what those works were, except that the chronicler did use them and names them as the sources for his own work. The chronicler's purpose, however, and I think this is important, is not to supplement Samuel Kings, nor is it to present an alternative history. Rather, the chronicler presents a magnificent theological interpretation of the history of God's salvific work in the world through his people Israel. And so this brings us to a crucial question. Does the chronicler have an eschatological purpose? Or does he merely recast the history of his people with contemporary political concerns in mind? Three basic answers have been given, and in fact, before I got up today, three people came to me and expressed amazement that there could be eschatology in the books of Chronicles, which do, in the words of one of my friends, those are nothing but dull books of history. Well, that position, I think, is reflected also in the one scholar who is perhaps the most influential in Chronicle studies over the last 30 years, and that's the Israeli scholar Sarah Yaffet. Now, she defines eschatology in the narrow sense as what we might commonly call future eschatology, that is to say, the annihilation of the existing world and the birth of a new world of everlasting salvation. This view would view the eschaton as something beyond history, beyond the time and space of the world as we know it. Now, that's in contrast to a broad sense of the term in Yaffet's view. What we might define as realized eschatology, the dawn of a new age of salvation that is in the course of history. According to this definition, eschatology envisions the creation of a new and different world in the context of the existing world, linked to time and history, to space and to form. Yaffet's own analysis of the Chronicles, though, leads her to conclude that the book of Chronicles cannot be defined as eschatological in any sense of the word. For Yaffet, and I think this may indeed reveal more of her rabbinic training than anything else, is that the primary principle underlying the book's worldview is acceptance of the existing world. No change in the world, according to Yaffet, is to be anticipated by the chronicler. Of course, Yaffet is not alone in this particular denial. She joined some very significant scholars, including Wilhelm Rudolph. Now, the other extreme I'll get to in a minute, but there is a mediating position. That mediating position is perhaps best represented by the scholar Roland DeVoe, who understands the chronicler to have a genuinely messianic hope, but it's a hope based on a pre-exilic dynastic form rather than an eschatological form. The consistent emphasis of the chronicler, according to DeVoe, upon the legitimacy and perpetual nature of the Davidic kingdom indicates a lively hope for a restoration of the Davidic hope. That's a mediating position. A third position is found in scholars among whom we would include von Rad, who find that Chronicles is in fact eschatologically oriented in its essence. Steinspring, for example, argued that the chronicler has an eschatological purpose which in his terms is reflected in the David of history and the David of faith. An extreme example of a Christological reading, as most scholarship would see it, but one to which I find myself strangely warm, is that of Nortje, who argues that the failures of the priesthood and the Davidic house point forward in time to the advent of Christ, the one true shepherd of Israel. I think a fourth alternative is perhaps the most helpful, and that's the alternative presented by Rudolf Moses. His eschatological reading of Chronicles is important because he emphasizes the paranetic, and by doing so expands the scholarly discussion far beyond simply the historical or legitimist perspectives. He takes the position that the Chronicles is not an historic work, but a theological system presented as history. The chronicler system, according to Moses, presents David, first Saul, then David, then Solomon, respectively, as representatives of judgment, restoration, and final redemption. The successors of Solomon become, in Moses' view, a repeating cycle of Saul and David epochs. The chronicler's own age, according to Moses, is a Davidic epoch. Now, Moses' insight is, in my opinion, critical not only for understanding the chronicler's eschatology, but also that of the Old Testament. Still, Moses' Saul, David, Solomon paradigm, as helpful as it might be, I think is finally misapplied by Moses at the end. The chronicler's own age is not, in my view, a Davidic age, but anticipates the coming of a new Davidic age, which itself will be fulfilled in a Solomonic epoch. Judah in the late 5th century BC is anything but a Davidic kingdom. Thoroughly dominated by a foreign power, Persia, unity of the kingdom was simply a distant reality, one that had existed in the past but was not extant in the present. The precise, for example, social and political context of the chronicler's own Judah in the 5th century is one that's really a bit unclear to us, except perhaps for the biblical books of Ezra and Nehemiah. We do know some things. We know that during this time period, there was a great deal of uncertainty about the power of Persia. International conflicts threatened the empire. Internal rebellion did as well. In Judah, that province of Persia, the government was more or less a conflation of both Persian and Israelite forms, operating somewhat as a semi-autonomous commonwealth, although always and significantly under the control of Persia. Within Judah itself, power structures were represented by various officials, and were often serious cause for strife. Complicating the internal political and social structure were tensions between what was called the Golah, that is the returnees, and the people of the land. Inevitable conflict was set up within post-exilic Judah, a conflict that's reflected among the various groups of people, all with an interest in the temple, but especially with the Sumerians, with whom there would ultimately be a complete ethnic and cultic split, especially with the Sumerian temple on Mount Gerizim. Now, this is important simply because biblical texts do not come to us in a vacuum. They are written within specific historical circumstances which shape the narrative. It is within this context of the political, social, and religious uncertainty of the time that the chronicler wrote his history. And that context of late 5th century Persian-dominated Judah is anything but another Davidic era. How do we get at that? Well, we could begin by looking at some of these broad sections, a macro structure. For example, and here I'll try to summarize my paper, the first nine chapters. Now, the first nine chapters, this long genealogy, by the way, is a lot more than just a biblical cure for insomnia. I think the reason some of you have probably not read Chronicles thoroughly is you couldn't get beyond chapter one. They take some work, but within those chapters is a magnificent structure. I've outlined it in the handout as a series of concentric circles, where beginning with the outer circle are the nations most distant from the center. And as one moves towards the center in these series of concentric circles, one finally comes to the very center of the chronicler's cosmology. And that is this particular tribes of Judah. Why Judah? Because from that tribe came the Davidic king. Benjamin. Why? Because it is within the territory of Benjamin that one finds Jerusalem with the temple. And finally, the Levitical tribe, that is the priestly tribe. In the Chronicles, what we find is a movement, both in literary structure and in themes, towards that center, always towards the Davidic king, towards the Levitical priesthood and the temple in Jerusalem. Those form the very center of the Chronicles' world. This is a particular movement, which I think is behind the words of Jesus in the book of Acts. You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, in all Judea and Samaria, to the ends of the earth. I think what we find in Jesus is the great reversal of what we read in Chronicles, where in Chronicles the movement is towards the center. With the coming of Messiah, the movement is from the center out. In other words, the sacramental presence of God, which must be found in the Old Testament, in kings, in priests and prophets, is in the New Testament identified as the sacramental presence of the prophet, priest, and king who seeks out the nations of the world. The next major section, that long section, chapter 10 of 1 Chronicles to the very end of the work, portrays the history of the nation of Israel from the death of Saul and the rise of David to the Babylonian exile and then beyond. The chronicler begins simply by transmitting in 1 Chronicles 10 his forelog, that is, 1 Samuel 31, the death of Saul. He speaks of nothing else before that in the narrative. He begins with Saul dying and David becoming king. But he includes a significant explanation of what happened with Saul and why David became king, material that is not synoptic, that is not found in Samuel Kings or anywhere else in the Old Testament. So Saul died for his unfaithfulness. He was unfaithful to the Lord because he did not obey the word of the Lord and also consulted a medium seeking guidance and did not seek guidance from the Lord. Therefore he, the antecedent God, slew him and turned the kingdom over to David, the son of Jesse. In this striking composition, the chronicler offers a critical insight into the themes that will dominate his history. Saul died for specific reasons. He died because he was unfaithful in that he did not obey the word of the Lord, and he sought guidance from a medium rather than from God. Now, these are precisely the reasons why the chronicler will, or what the chronicler identifies as the reasons at the end of 2 Chronicles, why the nation is destroyed by Babylon. It's because the priest and the people were unfaithful. They did not seek God. This has led Moses and other scholars, and I would include myself as one who follows this, that the death of Saul in 1 Chronicles 10 becomes a paradigm then for the later exile of Judah. That there is this, in fact, repeating cycle. And in that, I think Moses is absolutely correct. There is a repeating cycle. But I think we have to compare, and since I'm running out of time, I'll move to this as quickly as I can, the eschatology of the rise of David with that of Solomon. As you know, David is presented in, I hope you know, in Chronicles quite differently than he is in the books of Samuel Kings. In Chronicles, for example, there is no mention of David's great sin with Bathsheba. The chronicler doesn't deny that it happened. He recognizes Bathsheba as having existed. He names her as the mother of some of his sons. But what he doesn't mention is what happened, and as a result, he doesn't mention any of the stuff that falls out from that unfortunate event with Bathsheba. He does not mention, for example, the killing of Uriah. He does not mention, for example, the revolts that took place within David's own house. David in Chronicles comes out very, very differently than he does in Samuel Kings. In Chronicles, there is no battle with the house of Saul. David is immediately proclaimed king. In Samuel Kings, he first has a whole series of struggles with those who would keep him from the throne. Now, this is not to say that the chronicler does not recognize that all that stuff happened. He does. It just doesn't fit the program that he has, and as a result, he doesn't talk about it in his work. What we have in David in Chronicles is an almost messianic figure, one who arises out of the mess left by Saul at the end of 1 Chronicles 10 and Saul's unfaithfulness. And the first thing that happens is David in 1 Chronicles 11 is immediately crowned king over all Israel. And everybody acclaims him. The first thing he does is conquer Jerusalem and bring the ark to the city. He is a cultically faithful king. In the years to come, he will reign over a marvelous kingdom. David is the king to whom, or against whom, all further kings will, in fact, be measured. David does, however, really mess up. The one sin that the chronicler continues in his history is David's census of Israel. David also is a man of war. He fights battle after battle. He emerges victorious always, but he is a warrior. And as a result, he is forbidden from being the one who actually builds the temple in Jerusalem. David is its architect. He brings the materials. He establishes in long sections unique to the chronicler all of the orders of priests and Levites and doorkeepers and musicians within the temple. All that is credited to David, but David will not build the temple. That is the task of his son Solomon. Solomon becomes in many ways a greater king than the father. Solomon does all the things that his father did, and in fact, everything that we see in Solomon is contained in principle in his father David. As a result, we have a shift from a Davidic epoch in which the great king reigns, and yet the battles continue, to the Solomonic, when all the wealth of nations is brought to Solomon, when everyone stands in awe and fear of this great king, this son of David. What does that have to do with eschatology? It has this. A reading of the text from a canonical perspective leads us to some fascinating realities. The chronicler looks back at Saul and David and Solomon, and he sees a paradigm for the present and future, a paradigm which he proclaims in order to instill hope among his suffering countrymen. There is much to be learned from the past. In his history, the chronicler presented the history of the world and Israel within that world, not only by citing facts and events, but by identifying the narrative of God in the midst of the world's narrative. The chronicler directs his readers away from their present circumstances to a past which, on one hand, is far removed from them, but on the other, it remains a determinative factor in their contemporary setting. Unfaithfulness in failure to listen to the prophetic word and in seeking the Lord apart from his established order is always going to lead to disaster. It did for Saul. It did throughout the history of Judah. It did in 586 BC, and it does in 2000 AD. It is here that I both agree and disagree with Rudolf Moses. In Moses' reading, the epoch of Saul occurred with the exile, the epoch of David with the return, the epoch of Solomon was yet in the future. But there is nothing in the life of late 5th century Judah that would indicate that that could be identified as a Davidic epoch. Instead, the chronicler's age in the intertestamental period which followed was a time of anticipation. God, who once slew Saul and then raised up David, had slain the old Judah at the hand of the Babylonians, but had done so in order to raise up a new David. Rather than a Davidic epoch, the chronicler's era was a period between Saul and David. A new David was to come, yet that would take four more centuries. In the person of Jesus of Nazareth, the new and final David came to Israel. Everything was present in him, just as all things were present in the first David. And yet it was hidden within his assumed humanity. All the future of the eschatological kingdom was there. No evil, no pain, no illness, not even death itself could stand in his presence. Yet the new David, like the first, could be and was in fact subject to vicious attack. David of old fought war after war and yet always emerged victorious. The new David too was attacked. In fact, he was crucified. Yet, like the David of old, the new David could not be defeated. Easter morning brought final victory to the house of David, the house of Judah, the house of Israel, and in fact, the house of Adam. It is within that Davidic epoch that the church lives out her existence. He is declared as to be king by his followers, despite what his enemies may say of him. The church follows by faith, living in time and space the eschatological reality of the final Son of David. This is the defining reality for the Christian, one that was shared by the supporters of the first David as they saw him at Ziklag, and later by the chronicler as he looked beyond the humiliation of Persian rule to a future brightened by the second David. To this day, we do not see the glory which belongs to the Son of David that remains hidden to eyes of flesh. For the Christian reader of Saul's demise, the words of Jesus begin to take on new significance. When Simon Peter made his great confession, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," Jesus had responded, "You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." This is no small comfort for those who would confess the Son of David today. Though it appears that the Philistines around us have won, yet a star arises out of Judah, a light which is the very light of God himself. A new day is dawning, a day of the Son of David. He, like the David from whose line he came, is always present. Soon his kingdom will be manifested. Look beyond the present and see God's own future. This present Davidic age is to be succeeded in history by a new Solomonic era. This is the future of the universe, the age of the new temple, fully present already in the incarnate Christ and victoriously displayed at the eschaton. The shift from the present Davidic epoch to a future Solomonic epoch is a shift from the lived theology of the cross to a manifested theology of glory. This signals the great and final coronation feast. The feasts that were shared by those who celebrated David's coronation at Hebron and Solomon's coronation in Jerusalem, for all their joy, only pale when compared with the feast that awaits all believers. The eschatological feast brings together all the scattered children of God, not only those of Israel, but those separated children of Adam as well. The eternal feast even now sustains the church on earth. In every Eucharistic celebration, the gathered people of God look beyond the circumstances of life to a day that is a day of joy for all nations.